the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
It's good to be able to round off our series tonight in Deuteronomy. We've had a lot of good stuff out of Deuteronomy, haven't we? And this is going to be the final talk in the series. Some people do a lot of singing, and other people sing very rarely. It's the same in the Bible as well. There were some people who were singing all the time. You look at the number of psalms, for instance, that David is supposed to have written. I had to give a week of lectures on psalms in Sweden a few months ago, and I hadn't really thought about the massive output there must be, because most of David's psalms are not in the book of Psalms. We just get the cream of the crop. He was always writing songs and writing them in the most unusual situations as well. You couldn't write them down on the back of a bus ticket in those days either, so how he remembered them, I do not know, but he was always singing. Moses wasn't like that. Moses was one of those people who, when he burst into song, you knew it was special. And so there are two songs of Moses in the Bible. One is in Exodus chapter 15, at the start of his great adventure, when the Israelites have just got across the Red Sea, and they're out of Egypt. They're safe. God has proved his power in the most amazing way, and Moses' song there looks forward to what God is going to do. And then at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 32, you have the second song of Moses' lifetime. Looking back on all that God has done for his people, looking forward again, but looking at the way in which the Israelites over a generation in the wilderness have failed to keep up to their promises. And so it's a different kind of a song, equally confident in God's power, equally trusting in God's mercy, but at the same time with a tinge to it which comes of years and years of bitter experience. And it seems to me it's a pretty good way of summarizing the book of Deuteronomy to have a look at this. Just in case you can't remember too much of it, this is where we've been in the series. Paul started us all off talking about Deuteronomy chapters 1 to 3 and God's care for his people, the way he brings them through the desert. And Paul told us about the structure of the book, how it all fits together, and how Moses is reminding people at this stage of his life of things they already know, but they must not forget. And remembering is vitally important in this song we're going to look at tonight as well. Then Nick was speaking about taking to heart the things that God had said, and says living God's way is a choice of the heart. It's not just a matter of obedience like a robot. It's a matter of your heart being in the right place first and foremost, and that came from chapter 4. Then we had a look with Pam at the life in the land. When you get to the promised land, how are you going to organize and pattern the life of your nation? It's important to live out the instructions that God has given. God's law is not a matter of choice. It's not a casual suggestion about things we might do if we have a spare afternoon. It's absolutely vital to life and survival. Joe talked about one place to worship one God, about what worship means, about having the right attitude, and acting in the proper way so that what you're giving to God is your best and what he's asked for in the first place. And in that way, your relationship with God grows. Nick, again, talked about chapters 15 to 26, rather, and living as God's community. Whole life discipleship. And we do it together. We don't do it singly on our own. All of these themes have come to us already, but we'll see most of them reappearing in chapter 32. Elise was speaking about choosing life. Blessings for obedience, the curse for disobedience. Moses printed it pretty starkly, didn't he, when he said, "Behold, I have set before you life and death. Therefore, choose life that you and your children may live." Incidentally, that verse has got a special resonance for me, because when I was 14 years old, I was in a Christian rock band, and they said, you are the preacher. So at the end of every concert, I had to give a little evangelistic talk. And so I wrote one talk based on that verse, and that was it. Life, death, blessing or cursing. You choose, folks. Right, we're out of here. Thank you very much. But it actually worked on some occasions very well indeed. So that verse is always a special one for me. Anyway, after Elise, finally last week, we had Adrian talking about the next generation. Moses is passing on. And one thing that you find talked about quite a bit in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, is the way in which you hand on from one group of leaders to another. Transmission is very, very important so that you don't lose it on the way through. You see, God's purpose runs over generations, right through history. And so it's vital that as we pass on the baton to the next generation, they don't drop it. They don't lose the vision. And so it's vitally important to know how we can train others to come after us who will be ready to train others in their turn. And so all of that's been in there already. Now we've reached chapter 32 and Moses breaks into song for the second and final time in his life. It's often been noticed that this song, or at least the part of it, is a bit like the complaint that you often get through the Old Testament, often in the writings of the prophets, by God against his people, which sounds a bit like a lawsuit would have sounded in those days. We know that, actually, because we have Babylonian and Mesopotamian records which tell us exactly how a king would issue a complaint against a rebellious people. It would go through several stages, and you find those stages here in the song that Moses sings in chapter 32. You start by summoning witnesses, getting people together who are going to be witnesses that justice is being done. And of course, chapter 32 starts, "Listen, you heavens, and I will speak. Hear, you earth, the words of my mouth." God is calling the whole of creation to witness against his rebellious people. That's how serious this whole thing is. You go on from the summoning of witnesses to a historical review. The next thing that the king would do in his complaint would be to say, "I have done this, and I was always like that, and then they did this to me." And so you have the prosecution case. This is where they've gone wrong. This is why I'm going to judge against them. After you've done the prosecution bit, and of course there's a lot of that in chapter 32, there's the indictment. What is God going to do? And you find from verse 21 onwards, God is talking about that. "I will make them envious by those who are not a people. A fire will be kindled by my wrath," and so on. And then the fourth and final section of the lawsuit is the sentence. What is God going to do? And it's at this point that the poem goes on. And it stops being a typical patterned lawsuit. And there's another section which adds an extra dimension and tells you something about the character of God. This is the final bit. Those four bits, by the way, are 1 to 6, 7 to 14 that follow the pattern, 15 to 18, and then finally, I guess, 19 to 26, the sentence. But the fifth part comes from verse 27 onwards, and the first part of that is a lamentation. God may have to judge, but he doesn't want to. And if he destroys his people, what does that say about him? What will that do to onlooking pagans? Will they be amazed by God's power? No, they'll just think, "Oh, we did that. God has nothing to do with it." How is God going to respond? And so you find in verse 34, the judge deliberates. "Have I not kept this in reserve and sealed it in my vaults? I've thought about this for a very long time, and now I have to make a decision." And then you get the decision. And you find the decision is God is going to come in wrath, but he's going to hold his hand back. He's not going to destroy utterly, as he would have every right to do. Instead, he's going to restore his people and bring them back. And the end result of that will be that the whole earth will be blessed. And that's why at the end of the song in verse 43, he says, "Rejoice, you nations, with his people." Because God's chosen Israel to be a vehicle of his blessing to the whole of the earth. So if Israel's wiped out, there goes the hope for humankind. But if God can work through his people, can rebuild them into something very special, something which can take the message of the glory of God out to the ends of the earth, the whole of creation will benefit from that. And so the whole thing finally ends with a doxology, just as the song did in Exodus chapter 15, talking about the greatness and the glory of God and what God does to make his name great, faithful, and dependable. So that's the way that the song seems to be structured. Out of it come lots of themes, and I'm just going to pull out a few of these tonight, the ones that I think are most important. First, you hear a lot about the character of God in a way that we've seen God displayed right through Deuteronomy. We'll talk a little bit about that. Then, in the history bit, he goes on to talk about what God has done for his people. What kind of a God are we talking about? And when he comes to the indictment, he talks about the way in which they've followed false gods. And he gives some interesting description to those false gods, which we will look at just for a second. Then there's a section about the wrath of God and what it means to fall into the hands of the living God. Terrible thing, says the New Testament. Just how terrible? Why? Well, that's what the song tells us. And then the fifth bit, from the final section, the tacked on bit, the bit that doesn't belong in a lawsuit but is necessary if you're going to understand God, well, in that bit, you read about the mercy of God as well. So we're going to have a quick look at those five things, and that hopefully will wrap up the book of Deuteronomy for us. The first thing it said is about the character of God, and the first thing it says about that is that the character of God is good news for us. I mean, look at how the song starts. "Listen, you heavens, and I will speak. Hear, you earth, the words of my mouth. Let my teaching fall like rain and my words descend like dew. like showers on new grass, like abundant rain on tender plants. What I'm going to say about God is so nourishing, so nutritious, so encouraging. It'll be just like gentle moisture falling from heaven and bringing life-giving energy with it. This is what it's going to be like, because that's the kind of God we're dealing with. It reminded me when I read those verses of Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice. Do you remember Portia in the courtroom talking about mercy when Shylock looks as if he's not going to give it? And she says, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. Mercy falls like a gentle shower on the world and brings life wherever it goes. Well, Shakespeare knew his Bible surprisingly well for somebody who lived in the 16th, 17th century, and I think it's probable that he took that image in The Merchant of Venice straight from Deuteronomy 32, which he certainly knew. But that's a picture that's given of God, because God is the way he is. What I say about him is going to come across with vitalizing force, a gentle, energizing, life-building energy. So what does he say about the character of God? Well, I think three things stick out to me. First of all, that God is dependable in every situation. There is no situation in which he will ever let you down. And Moses says, he is the rock. His works are perfect and all his ways are just. And that phrase, the rock, is interesting, because it's used six times in this chapter about God. It's used elsewhere in the Old Testament too. And it's a phrase which not only the Israelites used about God, but all the nations around used about their gods as well. To compare God to a rock was a very common thing to do. But Moses says here, he is the rock. And they've given a capital R because Moses is making a difference between the way the pagans talk about their gods and the kind of God that we have. Because he says later on in the chapter in verse 31, for their rock, that's the pagan's rock, is not like our rock, as even our enemies concede. The Philistines, the Moabites, the people looking on, they have a God that they call their rock, but their rock is not the same as our rock, and even they see that. So he's dependable in every situation. Second, God is perfect in every action. And Moses says, he is the rock. His works are perfect. What he does right. There is no action that God does partly right and partly wrong. He's a craftsman. He gets everything absolutely perfect. I remember when we were young and working in Swindon with the Swindon Youth for Christ, and we were given an old premises in the centre of the town to use as a youth centre. It was run down, it was derelict, it had been the old Methodist Central Hall, but nobody had occupied it for a long time. And when we went in there, we found that it had been remarkably well put together in the early 1900s when it was built. They had had some real craftsmen working on the place. And I remember the staircase that went up from the ground floor into the balcony. And we had to redecorate the whole place. And so I had a good look at the staircase. And I realized that not only was it beautifully varnished and finished on the bits where people could see, but underneath, when you went right down into the corner, right in the angle of the stair, they'd kept that standard of craftsmanship and work going on right into the very corner. That was early 20th century Swindon workmanship. I was so impressed, because nobody cares about a corner like that. Nobody was ever going to go down there until I went down on my hands and knees to see what it was like 100 years before. But it was just tremendous work. And that's what Moses is saying about God. What he does right. Now, we don't always see that. And sometimes the things he does with us make you think, God, what are you playing at? He does it all right. His work is perfect. Dependable in every situation, perfect in every action, and upright in every decision. A faithful God who does no wrong, upright and just is he. Whatever he does with unflinching integrity. And that's the kind of God on whom you can depend, says Moses, unlike the gods of the nations. And what has he done for his people? Well, here he backtracks and looks at the things that God has done. And he says once again three things. First of all, God is a God who chooses. Verse 8, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided up the human race, he set up boundaries for the people according to the number of the sons of Israel. In other words, God decided where everybody was going to live and what nations they were going to fall into. Paul talks about that, you remember, in the sermon he gives in Acts 17 in Athens. And God puts people down in the places that he has decided. But he's done it in such a way that Israel is right at the center of his plan. They are chosen by him. Not just in the days of Abraham, But long before that, when God was deciding how many nations there would be and where they would be, God, right from the start, has chosen his people. We had the first part of the membership course this morning, and through there we were talking to people who are thinking about church membership about what it means to be a member of a church. And there's a memory verse for each week of that course. And the memory verse this first week of the course is from 1 Peter chapter 1. And 1 Peter is a letter that Peter writes from Rome to people whom he knows are going to go through intense suffering in the next few years. And he says, listen, you're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You're chosen by God. You're going to be taken and thrown into prison. Some of you will lose your lives. Some of you will have hearts failing you for fear, and you'll give up Christianity. But always remember, and it will see you through, that you are not here by some accident. It's not a haphazard coincidental thing that you're a Christian. You are chosen. God's elect according to his foreknowledge, he says. And that's a tremendous thing, isn't it? God chooses. We're not in some random situation that he hasn't foreseen. He knew where we would be, and he chose us to be with him. Second, he protects. God not only chose Israel, but looks after him. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, verse 11, and hovers over its young, the Lord carries him on its pinions. The Lord alone led Israel. No foreign God was with him. And so finding him in the desert, verse 10, in a barren and howling waste, he shields him, he lifts him, he carries him on eagle's wings. God is a God who not only chooses us, but he protects us from all dangers too. But that's not the end of the whole story. It's not just negative protection. It's positive. God blesses in the most amazing way. He nourished him with honey from the rock and with oil from the flinty crag, with curds and milk from herd and flock and with fattened lambs and goats. How could a bunch of slaves escaping from Egypt, making a jailbreak across the desert, ever expect the blessings that God gave in one of the most wonderful countries on earth? I went to Israel back in October, and of course John Airdrie's been there just recently, and Ruth, and it's just an amazing place, as I'm sure the Airdrie's would agree with me. Yep, you'd go back. Yeah, it's a fantastic place, and I'm not talking politically now about Jews and Arabs or anything like that. Just the sheer geographical situation is absolutely wonderful, and the Israelites were just staggered. Goes back to what Derek was saying this morning, doesn't it, about God's grace. Grace is when you get what you really don't deserve, and God gives it to you anyway. So God chooses, God protects, God blesses, and we need to remember that. This is the church in a village called Broadwas-on-Teme in Worcestershire. I lived there for just a year when I was 14 years old. Our family moved down from Scotland permanently to Worcestershire, and within a year, my father's job had decided that he had to go back permanently. And I have to admit that even as a young Scottish nationalist, I found it great living in Worcestershire for a year. It was a fantastic place to be. And I have lots of memories of Broadwas, not particularly of the pub, I must admit, but that was the only other picture I could find. And I decided a couple of years ago, when I was on my way up the motorway, to go back and have a look at Broadwas. I had not been there since I was 15. Been past it several times, not been through the village. And you know, it was interesting, because when I got there, I found all my memories came to life again. And it was as I remembered it, but not just as I remembered it. My memories had become distorted over the years. So I remembered some things very clearly. But I kept on thinking, oh, I didn't remember that lane led there. I thought this hill was much shorter. And that road was much steeper. What was in the place where that house is? I can't remember. And I found that I still had the memories, but the memories had become twisted and distorted. That can happen to the way you think about God unless you keep on reminding yourself of what he's like. And that's why Moses is saying, remember, 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 right through Deuteronomy. We need to refresh our memory. J.B. Phillips, the Bible translator, wrote a book some years ago called Your God is Too Small. And it came as a result of a conversation that he had with a woman when he said to her, do you think God understands radar? Which was a very trendy subject in those days. This is back in the Middle Ages. Never mind. And she just said immediately, oh, no. And then she laughed because she realized what a silly thing that was. But it can be like that, can't it? We tend to think of God as interested in certain things and not really up to date on others. I've had a couple of people say to me over the last week, it was really interesting hearing about internet evangelism and how the internet is a gift from God last Sunday, because I always thought God is over here and the internet's over there and he's probably not heard about it yet. And you can easily get to limiting God, can't you? Just because you fail to keep on reminding yourself of his power and his love and his dependability and all of the other things. Well, Israel certainly did. And they went chasing after false gods instead. And that's the next thing the song tells us about, the pursuit of false gods. And Moses says three things about them. They're unfamiliar gods. They sacrificed to demons, verse 17, which are not God. Gods they had not known. Unfamiliar gods. Sometimes, you know, human beings like novelty. And that's one of the problems, isn't it? You can get so bored with something you get used to, even if it's great. God is just such a staggering God. You can shut your eyes and talk to him whenever you want. You start praying and immediately you're in contact with the power center of the universe. That is incredible. And the end result is we get so used to it, we never pray. Can be that way anyway, can't it? And so what's novel, what's different, what's out there can seem much, much more exciting. And so the Israelites got interested in unfamiliar gods. Gods they had not known. Gods that recently appeared as well. Gods that were fashionable. And we can live our lives for fashionable things. For things that everybody else is living for. For things that seem cutting edge in our society. Oh sure, we pay lip service to the God of heaven. We come to Belmont every Sunday. We live lives as good Christians ought to. We pay our taxes and we don't do anything wrong. But at the same time our hearts are in other things. The things that the rest of the world is shooting for, is living for. And what gets us out of bed in the morning is not the God of heaven, but the fashionable things that crowd our mind and fill our thoughts through the day. Unfamiliar gods, fashionable gods, and gods with no track record. He says, gods they had not known, gods that recently appeared, and gods your ancestors did not fear. You know you can trust God. Because your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather all followed that God, and did he ever let them down? Not once. And these gods, these new gods, have got no track record whatsoever. How do you know they're any use? But sometimes we just want the new, we want the novel, we want the fashionable, and that's the way that the Israelites' hearts were going. And Deuteronomy poses us a question, doesn't it? Okay, we don't build idols in the back garden. At least if you do, come and talk to the leadership team about it, will you? But it's possible for us to harbour false gods in our hearts. An idol is anything that absorbs the thoughts and the intentions and the emotions and the desires of its worshipper. And there may be all sorts of false gods that we don't realise are gods that are starting to take over our life. That certainly is what happened to Israel anyhow. And Chris Wright, who's written a wonderful commentary on Deuteronomy, says at this point in chapter 32, false gods never fail to fail. Sadly, we never fail to forget. But Moses isn't finished. There are two more things to talk about. He's got to deliver sentence. And so he talks about the wrath of God. And when you look at some of the things that are said here, you begin to understand why Richard Dawkins says that the Old Testament God is the most unpleasant character in the whole of fiction. Because it sounds pretty awful, doesn't it? The sword will make them childless. The young men and young women will perish, the infants and those with grey hair. Fire, pestilence, plague, the fangs of wild beef, the venom of vipers that glide in the dust. Well, back in 1969, a great Bible scholar, Delbert Hillers, wrote this book called Covenant, about the sorts of things that happened in covenants in Old Testament days. When a king made a covenant with a people who rebelled against him, these were exactly the kinds of things that he would mention in his lawsuit. So Moses isn't inventing things. God will strike you with boils and plagues, and he'll pour down molten lead from the sky instead of rain, and he'll make it very nasty. He wasn't making it up as he went along. He was simply quoting the kinds of things that were said in these kind of things anyway. And Hiller said this, the prophets, and he includes Moses in this, were not arbitrary in choosing the lurid figures in which they depicted the wrath to come. They weren't indulging a morbid imagination, but were fundamentally like lawyers quoting the law. This is just what the covenant said would happen. So Moses isn't being vindictive here. It'll be nasty, it'll be horrible, oh, you're going to burn. He's just saying, look, you've brought it on yourselves. All I'm quoting is what you yourselves signed up to and agreed with. That's how serious it is, folks. And so what he says about the wrath of God, once again, I can find three things in there. First of all, God's feelings about it. Jealousy. And God says he's jealous for his people. Verse 21, they made me jealous by what is no God and angered me with their worthless idols. God jealous. Ooh, that sounds a little bit kind of undignified for God, wouldn't you say? Yes, but think about what jealousy means. For human beings, jealousy is a very unattractive quality because it's usually related to something he's got and I haven't. I want his iPod. I want his girlfriend. I want his car. I want his house. So he doesn't really deserve one of those. I should have one of those. And it's a very unattractive quality. Now, God's not like that. God owns the cattle on a thousand hills, which is far more cows than I would want, I must admit. But, God's wealth is infinite. There is nothing that he cannot have. And so he's not jealous of something he's got no right to. I think God's jealousy is a way of saying, in as human terms as you can make it understandable, that God burns with despair when he sees people taking something that belongs in one place and abusing it in another. And God is especially jealous for the affections of his people because he has a right to them. Because he knows that if their affections are fixed anywhere else, it's not just going to be hurtful for him, it's going to be disastrous for them as well. And so God wants to see everything in the place it should be in his universe because he wants the good of his creation. He wants the flourishing of human life. And he's not being jealous because he's saying, oh, you're going to play with him and not with me. That's not right. Well, I'm taking my ball and going home then. God is not like that. And God's jealousy is because he has a right. I suppose it's a limited human analogy, but suppose I'm standing here with my wife, who has now deserted me. As you can see, my family are useless tonight. And I'm standing with Anthea at the end of the service, and somebody comes up and ignores me completely. And instead, he says to my wife, hey, Anthea, you're looking hot tonight. How about you come back to my place and we get acquainted a bit more? I might well say, excuse me? And I think I'd have a right to be jealous. Because that woman has made promises to me, and I have made promises to her, and we have an exclusive relationship with one another, which nobody else is allowed to trash or step in on. I would have the right. And similarly here, God has got promises from Israel. God has got a love for Israel, which they have started to respond to and then got away from. No wonder he feels as he does. So it's not a petty thing at all. It's a great thing. If you don't feel jealous in situations like that, there's something wrong with you. If you're a king who has a province in his country which is invaded by a foreign power, and then you say, oh, well, those people were never much use anyway, he can have it, never mind, I've got plenty more provinces. The people who live there would not feel best pleased with you, because you're supposed to be their king. You're supposed to be careful for them. You don't just let them wander off in any old way. Second, the judgment. And he talks about fire. A fire, verse 22, will be kindled by my wrath, one that burns down to the realm of the dead below. It will devour the earth and its harvest and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. Why fire? Well, because fire searches everywhere. It's hard to stop fire spreading, as sadly the Philpott family found a few weeks ago. When you start it, it's just unstoppable. It can get into places you never thought it was going to get into. And God's judgment searches out the smallest details of our lives. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. So much more we could say about that. But the result is important to focus on as well. And the result here is terror. Verse 25, in the street the sword will make them childless. In their homes terror will reign. It stretches to the young and to the old, to the infants, to everybody. And they just don't know what's going to happen. Because when you get into the hands of the judgment of God, you lose all perspective, you lose all hope. There is no way ahead. There's no way you can make plans, you can think about the future. You're simply gripped by terror because you realize there is nothing you can do. But then it changes. We've reached the end of the lawsuit. It looks as bleak as possible. And God starts this process of changing his mind. And so the final section, very, very quickly, is about the mercy of God. Three things here. Pity for the helpless. God looks at his people and he says, excuse me, he'll relent concerning his servants when he sees their strength is gone and no one is left slave or free. Verse 37, he'll say, now where are their gods, the rock they took refuge in? The gods who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings, see now that I myself am he. God is not going to leave his people deserted. He's going to bring them back. I put to death and I bring to life. I have wounded and I will heal. And no one can deliver out of my hand. God has pity because even in the worst of his judgment, he still loves his people. That love that will not let them go. And so the second thing is power for the weak. I will make my arrows drunk with blood while my sword devours flesh. And think, oh, here we go again. No, he's not talking now about the Israelites. He's talking about everybody who opposes them. the blood of the slain and the captives, the heads of the enemy leaders. Every last destructive force that comes against God's people will be destroyed in its turn. Whatever enemies we face, doubt, depression, fear, death itself, Jesus is the victor over every situation. Pity for the helpless, power for the weak. And the third thing we're assured in this section, it seems to me, is peace for the afflicted. Because their enemies are gone, because God takes vengeance on his enemies and makes atonement for his land and his people, there is total security in belonging to him. And so Moses says, just remember. Remember what God is like. Remember where you have strayed. Remember God's wrath. Remember God's mercy. Remember the delusions of false gods and just how false they are. Bring it all to your mind again and again, because I'm going to die and I'm not going to be around to remind you. Keep on remembering, because in keeping these memories going, there is strength. And so the book of Deuteronomy, for hundreds and hundreds of years, has been a memory aid to Christians. And the church, with the book of Deuteronomy, has been enabled to survive through generation after generation, because what Moses wanted to happen has happened, and we have remembered. We need to do that. But there's one last thing I just want to say before we sing our final song or couple of songs tonight, and that is, this whole thing is about mission. What? You read Chris Wright's commentary. He's the principal of All Nations College, and so he has a special interest in mission, because All Nations is a college that especially tries to train people who are going to the ends of the earth to serve God. But he makes the point very clearly when he talks about this song. It's not just about Israel, it's about the nations, about their rock and how inferior their faith is, and about how some of them will rise against Israel and just will not understand what's going on. And when Moses says, if only they were wise and could understand this, in verse 29, and discern what their end will be, he's not talking about the Israelites, he's talking about the others. And so God's heart and God's vision through this whole song, and you can read it for yourself and see that it's there, is not just for Israel, but for all of those on whom Israel will have an effect. And that's why when you reach the end, it's rejoice, you nations, with his people. Because God's whole purpose is to purify and cleanse Israel, to turn them into a people who will represent his name to the ends of the earth. And we haven't talked about Romans 5. There wasn't time. There's plenty of Deuteronomy to talk about tonight. But if you read that chapter and then read on in Romans and see how God's plan to bring people back to himself works out in a New Testament context, you find in Romans chapters 9 to 11, Moses tangles with this, tangles with this chapter once again. And the whole message of the book of Deuteronomy, and comes up with an argument about the people of Israel, which says, now I see what God was doing right through the Israel story. He was preparing us to be the Israel of God, us in the church worldwide. We who now take the name of God out to the ends of the earth, and we've been grafted into the plant. So what God says here in Deuteronomy to Moses, he says to us still, and we have the job of taking the message out to the ends of the earth. So Moses says, remember. The people of Israel failed to remember again and again down through the rest of the history of the Old Testament. Important in our day, we look at the challenge of Deuteronomy 32, in fact, of the whole book of Deuteronomy, and remember in our turn.